Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solari Report. This is Catherine Austin Fitz. I'm joined today by Ricardo Oscam, who is the investment analyst who helps me with Solari Screens, but also has been building with us the Building Wealth curriculum. Ricardo, Carolyn Betts, and I were just in a wonderful conference in Sweden and then did two speaking events, one in Oslo and Stavanger. In Norway, we gave a presentation called Busting the Myths Busting the Myths in Your Money Map that was inspired by many of the myths we were bumping into. And we decided, okay, let's do it. We want to do it again in a more extended version for the Solari Report subscribers. So Ricardo, welcome to the Solari Report. Thank you for helping us with this.
Thank you very much, Catherine. Happy to be back.
So I just want to say before we dive in, you've prepared a wonderful PowerPoint. We're going to be talking today about 10 myths, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
10 myths. And these are myths that we continually bump into. And I think part of putting this presentation together was something hit the last straw. We said, look, we've got to clearly disabuse these myths once and for all. And we're going to keep it very high level and very simple. But these are critical frameworks to understand what's going on in the world and to help you build a good map.
Yes. And the important note there is that these are not myths that are contributing to our understanding of the world. These are not the myths, the Greek myths that give us a sense of moral justice or the story of the hero. These are false myths, myths that we believe in that are destructive to our behavior.
Right. And are used to trick us and harvest us. Okay. So let's dive in.
So let me pull up the slides now. Busting the myths in your money map. And this this map that we see here on screen is the Isle of California. And as we all know today, the island of California isn't actually an island. It is a peninsula. So it is connected at the top to the mainland of the North American continent. And this was a map that was created in the early 1500s. When the Spanish Crusaders came to the west coast of the United States, which wasn't the United States back then, but they arrived there with their boats. And when they came to this island, they had only discovered the southern part of it. And because they thought that this was an island, they drew it this way. And as you can see, the northern part is empty, is not yet discovered. But what happened is when a ship of Dutch pirates conquered all the bounty on one of these Spanish ships, they also conquered this map. They confiscated it. And the Dutch at the time were great cartographers. They were world renowned. And when they used this map to construct all sorts of follow-up maps, the false news soon spread that this was indeed an island. And it took 2.5 hundred years until the false myth of the island of California was finally broken. And it took a proclamation from the Spanish king to do that.
Can you imagine?
2.5 hundred years, people were going on adventures, going on these pioneering journeys with a false map. And that led to many deaths because people broke apart the ship and then pulled it all the way across the desert, all the way across these mountains, because they thought they would run into more water up north. But they didn't, of course. So that led to many failed journeys. So this really tells us two things. One is that there is such a thing as a false narrative, an official reality, and then there is such a thing as reality, the thing that's actually real. And you want to do all of your risk management based on reality. Otherwise, you might just lose everything in the journey. So that's one thing. The other thing is you want to use the right framework. You want to use the right map to do your planning. So that's why today we are going to do some myth busting and hopefully give people a better framework so that they can do that more successfully, risk managed in this environment.
So just let me add one thing. If you look at the return on investment on any of those exploration voyages, a bad map took a very expensive expedition and turned it from something that could have made money to something that loses a great deal of capital.
Right.
So bad intelligence it's the difference between success and failure.
That's right.
So let's go.
All right. So let's jump in. Without further ado, myth number one is that we have a purely financial problem. So, Catherine, why do we have more than just a financial problem?
So I always describe the financial system as just a subsection of the governance system. And you can't fiddle with one without fiddling with the other. And you have to look at them whole. So oftentimes, so I say the truth. So let's pull up the truth. The truth is that we have a secret governance problem. And part of that is you have a whole group of players in the secret governance system who have sovereign immunity or act above the law, whether it's because they have the physical power and capability to do it or they have sovereign immunity. And so, you know, oftentimes we will see many people say, and we heard this in Stavanger, fix the money, you fix the world. Well, no, if you fix the money, you just take it to the next phase that the secret governance system is using. And we are often sort of tricked into these, we're going to reform everything by fixing the financial system. And of course, all you do is evolve the financial system and you never deal with the real problem, which is the secret governance system. And that's why transparency about Mr. Global is so very important. And just remember, you can't, you know, we need to fix the governance system. Fixing the financial system ain't enough.
Right. One of the important things you shared with me when I just met you in late 2020 is you said there is absolutely no shortage in wealth in the world. And
right.
The tricky thing is that it's all being sucked into a very centralized system to a couple of players that seem to be taking up a lot of market share. And that's not necessarily based on something productive. So the thing is, we need to adjust that problem. We need to find a way to decentralize that in a productive way to make sure that the wealth is more evenly distributed across the players that are doing something productive.
Right. So think of your neighborhood. If your neighborhood has been overrun with mafia, the problem is not your financial system, right?
That's right.
Right. You have an organized crime problem.
That's right.
Right.
Is it also fair to say that therefore there is no financial solution to this political problem?
Right. So that's, you know, we cannot solve a political problem with a financial solution. And that those two things get mixed up. One of the reasons they get mixed up is dealing with the secret governance system, trying to understand it or trying to figure out how we could reform it seems overwhelming. Most people feel, oh, well, I can't do that, but I can, you know, I can promote sound money. That's, you know, that's within my scope. And the reality is, you know, just because it looks overwhelming doesn't mean it can't be dealt with, but it requires sort of, you know, we have to face the fact we have a political problem and it can't be solved with money.
That's right. So there you have it. Truth number one, we have a secret governance problem, not just a financial problem. You ready for myth number two, Catherine?
Go for it.
There is no plan to institute central control. There is none.
I'll never forget when I published the Dylan Reed book and I sent it to Foster Gamble and he called me and he said, all my life, I thought all this idea about a central, you know, a group centralizing political control to a highly central level was all complete hooey. And he said, I just realized it's really true. So let's look at the truth.
So the truth is there is a plan to institute central control and to end human liberty. And I think it's fair to say that those two go hand in hand. Because for one thing to happen, you need to end the other.
Right.
For central control to exist, you need to take away all the freedom of human liberty.
Right. And it's important to understand, if you look at the things that led to democratic process and the sort of blossoming of the economy in the West, one of the reasons that happened was slavery was not working. I would argue historically slavery has been the most profitable business through the ages globally. At the same time, there are real problems with it, many of which, if not all of it, digital technology solves. And so it's hard for many people to fathom that anybody would want the extent of the central control that is being pushed for. But that's exactly what is happening. So I think we have a few videos to point this out, correct?
Yes, ma'am. So let's jump right in. So this is Agustin Carstens.
All our analysis on CBDC, in particular for the use of general use, we tend to establish the equivalence with cash. And there is a huge difference there. For example, in cash, we don't know, for example, who's using a $100 bill today. We don't know who is using a 1,000 peso bill today. A key difference with the CBDC is that central bank will have absolute control on the rules and regulations that will determine the use of that expression of central bank liability. And also, we will have the technology to enforce that. Those two issues are extremely important, and that makes a huge difference with respect to what cash is.
So that was Augustine Carsons, who's the head of the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. And the BIS is running the process to implement CBDC globally. There are about 114 countries now who have been or are prototyping. I think most everybody in the Salary Report has probably seen this video. It came from an IMF October 2020 panel. And it's one of those rare moments, Ricardo, when a central banker really tells you the truth. Because what he's saying is, you know, if they don't want your money working 5 minutes from your home, it's not going to work 5 minutes from the home. If they don't want you buying pizza, you can't buy pizza. They can make those rules and implement them all with algorithms, AI, digital technology. And, you know, God love Carsons. He told us the truth. The next one is even better. It's the president, the Federal Reserve Bank, which is the central bank of the United States, has 12 banks that are privately owned. They run the system. This is Neel Kashkari, who's the president of the Minneapolis Fed. So this is a Fed president who was speaking at Columbia University earlier this year, telling you what you should think of this kind of financial transaction control.
Because I'm pretty skeptical. I keep asking anybody at the Fed or outside of the Fed to explain to me what problem this is solving. I can send anybody in this room $5 with Venmo right now, right? No, seriously. So what is it that a CBDC could do that Venmo can't do? And all I get is a bunch of hand waving. I get a bunch, well, maybe it's better for financial inclusion. Maybe it's better for cross-border remittances. Maybe, is there any evidence that it is? And you know, they say, well, what about China? China's doing it. Well, I can see why China would do it. If they want to monitor every one of your transactions, you could do that with a central bank digital currency. You can't do that with Venmo. If you want to impose negative interest rates, you could do that with a central bank digital currency. You can't do that with Venmo. And if you want to directly tax customer accounts, you could do that with the central bank digital currency. You can't do that with Venmo. So I get why China would be interested. Why would the American people be for that?
So, Catherine, why would the United States people be in favor of a central bank digital currency?
Because they didn't know in time to stop it. That is the only reason. If I think, and it's not just CBDC, because you can implement the same kind of central controls that Carson's talking about without a CBDC. You can just do it through the credit cards and the payment systems and the banking system if you have the right technology in place. And I think this is a technology, I liken it to a control grid where, you know, they bring up three sides of the corral around the cattle or the livestock, and CBDC and digital IDs is the last gate to snap shut. And the problem is you go from being free and being free to walk out to suddenly that last gate shuts in and you are now in a digital concentration camp. It's extraordinary. And if you look at how they've been sneaking up on the herd for a long time, I think many people can't fathom that this is coming. Now, if you look at the way cash use is rising, somebody's figured it out and somebody's pushing back. So, and that's part of what we're trying to do at the Salary Report. We just launched a collection of 70 short CBDC videos to help you send around. We'll have it linked in the related reading to this Salary Report. You know, get that information far and wide. Transparency is one of the best ways to stop CBDC. Okay, you want to introduce the next one?
Yeah,
this
definitely.
Is a doozy.
Yeah, sure. But before we jump right in, just a comment about the two gentlemen we've seen before alluding to what this entails, rolling out the central bank digital currencies, is that this information is coming straight from the horse's mouth.
Right.
Anybody who thinks that this is controversial or thinks that this is some hokey conspiracy theory, just sit yourself down behind the screen and go through that CBDC collection.
How many of those have you looked at, Ricardo?
Oh, I've gone through them.
It's incredible. They're telling you what they're going to do.
It's right there. There's nothing controversial about this whatsoever. It's hidden in plain sight. It's there for people to watch. So in any conversation with somebody who is a disbeliever.
So remember, this is taxation without representation. So they can go into your bank account and just take your, well, it's not your money. They say it's their money.
That's right. It will be the ultimate form of central control. The ultimate one, which leads me to a question. What happens to that tranche system within the United States between federal and state levels? What if you get that central bank digital currency being able to do the heavy lifting?
Well, it's even greater than that, because at some point, if you look at how this system can work, why would the BIS bother with the Fed? Right?
So it will be a global thing. Global role.
Well, here's the question. Can the states or any other jurisdiction create independent payment mechanisms so that the Federal Reserve or any of the Federal Reserve banks can control their transactions? Now, clearly we can take out old-timey checks and do Pony Express and bicycles, but that's going to be very cumbersome. And, you know, the reality is, can local or regional or state jurisdictions come up with an infrastructure, independent payment mechanisms to prevent this from happening? We saw Governor DeSantis, and this is in the CBDC collection, come out and say he was outlawing CBDCs in Florida, but that's not enough. If you don't have independent payment mechanisms, you know, you can still be locked down with Visa card.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. So it's also, it's a political thing. It's a governance problem.
Right.
This is the perfect example. One other thing that I read when I read about these developing currencies is Marco Polo's book about Kublai Khan and everything he saw in Asia happening. And Kublai Khan had this currency called the Chao that he rolled out, which was a paper money backed by silver. But he did something very interesting. He said, again, back to the governance problem, that everybody had to, they were forced by law, repay their taxes with that new chow, with that new currency.
Right. He made it legal tender.
Exactly. He made it legal tender. But it was enforced by law in a way that if you didn't, you would be sentenced to death.
Right. So that's why they call it the central bank warfare model, because the central banks print the money, but the people with the guns make sure they use it.
There you go.
Right.
There you go. All right, Catherine, on to video number 3.
So this is Professor Richard Werner, who's a great favorite of, I dare say, yours, Ricardo, and mine as well.
That's right.
Who is, in my opinion, the top academic scholar in the world on central banking, but also on banking and its interaction with the economy. And Richard has written a great piece for us about the importance of this independent payment power and sovereign banks. But he gave a speech at Malmo, Sweden last year. It was 2022 May, the Northern Light Convention. And he talked during the panel about what a CBDC would look like. So we always talk about a CBDC like it's something on a digital system. Richard brought it down to a much more concrete level. So why don't we play that?
It's possible that even if you have to have CBDC in some form, that you're not destroying the banking system. If you do it the way China is doing it, now you have to remember China only recently introduced their banking system, and it seems they were not willing to already give it up. They have already CBDC. It's still a pilot project, but it's introduced, you know, among millions of people already. But it was introduced on purpose in such a way that it would not harm the banking system, and therefore is a more truthful sort of update of the old paper money. But of course, it still has the control aspect. So at least it's not killing the banking system. The way they do this is by requiring you to have a bank account in order to get CBDC. So it's not a direct account at the central bank. It's only through your bank that you can get it. You see how simple that is, and of course could be done over here, but they're not discussing it say the ECB is not discussing it, because you see their agenda is to get rid of banks. But this alternative exists. But then, of course, the key problem is this control aspect. which at the moment they haven't stepped up in China, but that can be introduced any time. And that, of course, is a concern. Also, they never talk about the nature of this CBDC. What is it actually going to look like? They never talk about that. Right. But I heard one European central banker tell me what it's going to look like. He saw it. He was invited to one of the old central banks in Europe that are very much promoting this. And they showed him. And, you know, he's a top, executive director of another central bank in Europe. And there's no reason to believe that he was telling me a story. And he was around this large and would be implanted under your skin. So that is the plan. And of course, that has other implications on top of what we've mentioned, on top of the control aspects, because that actually enters your body. In my view, violates human dignity, and can be then used for even in terms of functionality beyond the monetary and economic transaction purposes. So highly dangerous and definitely something we have to oppose. And so using cash is one of the things we can do to make sure that it will be, the hurdle will be higher for the central planners to introduce the CBDC.
Great. That was really a breakthrough moment, because you know, oftentimes we try and warn people and it's hard for them to fathom that it's really that bad. And then someone like Richard gets up and presents, and it was a magical moment because the audience really shifted. Okay, so let's go to our next myth.
Before we do that, can I just share one thing about Richard?
Sure.
Whenever I speak to Richard, one thing that he seems to really be very different than other economists in the way that his work is very empirical, is based on empirical evidence. So he studies empirical data. And by doing that and not just relying on all these former sort of ancient economists that have built upon others' work and then relying on these axioms that rely on other axioms, et cetera, he just disregards that and looks at the evidence. He looks at the data. And one thing he has proven without a shadow of a doubt, and I encourage everybody to read his work, is that if local banks give out productive loans, and they usually do that to smaller firms, smaller banks lend out to smaller firms, and they do that in a productive way, that gives you economic growth without inflation.
Right.
And that begs the question, what happens if the centralizing effort leads to a handful or just one global central bank issuing this CBDC or some equivalent?
It's a harvesting machine. It's not a growth machine. And to the extent that it pumps out lots of money that creates speculative bubbles, it does create inflation. So, and the magnificent thing about Richard's work is, you know, you're talking about an economy that can not only grow without inflation, but it can also heal the environment without inflation. So you can have growth with an improving environment with no inflation. And it just, you know, it comes back to the very simple fact that things can work. But they can't work if you have an organized crime problem that's constantly harvesting you economically. And I think by Richard proving what health could look like and how to get it, he's done almost a better job than any economist in the world at busting what Charlie Stevens calls the rackets.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
So this is a clear case for abundance. I would say it's very hopeful.
It's very hopeful.
It's very hopeful.
We have published Richard's speech in Malmo, and it was on that model, the model of growth, and his work and research on that. And, you know, and part of what has enabled Richard to do this is very early on, he really unpacked the central banking systems when he worked with the Japanese central bank and wrote The Princes of the Yen. So, but you're right. I think it is exceptionally helpful work.
All right, Catherine, on to myth number three. Fiat currency is bad.
Okay, so I would say there's been no currency system in the history of man that doesn't have pros and cons. There's no perfect currency system. But and I refer to Alexander Delmar, who was a very famous monetary historian in the late 1800s. But And we have a book review of Del Mar up at Solari, but Del Mar, after looking at sort of 50 centuries of currency experience, concluded that fiat currency was in fact the best system where it was well governed. Now, where it's poorly governed, you know, it doesn't work, but that's true for every currency. The runner-up could arguably be commodities currencies, you know, primarily gold and silver. The problem is swings in the commodities market can wreak havoc with a well-governed system in ways that would never happen with fiat currency, and he documents that very well.
Yeah.
But we have rather than say we have a secret governance system which is killing us, we have excused what is happening by saying, oh, it's fiat currency. That's the problem.
Yes.
And of course, you know, that's saying that the problem is financial, which it's not. And solving that symptom, you know, so we have a fiat currency that's not well governed.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the fact that it's fiat that's the problem. So let's look at what the truth is.
Exactly. So this is the truth. Debt-based currency based on sovereign debt traps and secret governance systems, that is bad. That is the problem.
Right. That's so it's the debt trap. And you're looking at the image. We did a wrap-up in 2015 pointing out, coming out of the financial crisis, that the petrodollar was being replaced with a debt dollar, and you were watching sovereign governments all over the world being swept into a dollar debt trap. So... debt, sovereign governments, you know, one of my favorite things to point out is I talk a lot about the money missing from the federal government. So $21 trillion missing from the U.S. federal government. But if you look at the debt, let's say the current debt is $33 trillion. We didn't need to issue $33 trillion and we didn't need to pay lots of interest on that $33 trillion. The Treasury could have just issued the currency and we would have no debt and no problems.
Yes.
You know, no, I don't know what the interest, I think the interest on the debt is approaching, you know, it's getting more than the military budget. Why are we paying that? The Treasury could have just issued the currency. So you have a $33 trillion unnecessary debt and you're missing $21 trillion on top of it. And that's a $54 trillion hole that doesn't have to exist.
Borrowed from a private institution that's hidden.
Right, it's secret.
Not transparent. That's right.
As one of my great allies used to say is, where is the money? Where is the money? It's all disappearing down this black hole.
Yes.
Okay, and so what's number four?
Yes, before we do that, Catherine, I want to ask a question on this one.
Because
you mentioned Alexander Del Mar. One of the things when he talks about fiat versus a commodity-based currency, one of the things he points out is, as a problem of the commodity-based currency, is the shortage of availability of that commodity. So say you do it based on gold or silver. Back then, these ancient civilizations, they didn't have the more modern mining capabilities that we have today. So they weren't necessarily able to create more currency because they didn't have more silver.
Right. Or sometimes you get a mother load of discovery of silver and it would completely, you know, whack the currency around. So you were very dependent on the vagaries in the commodities market.
Yes.
There were two things I did want to point out. And one was I'm very concerned about this myth because there is a push to use sound money as a solution to our problem. And that sound money system can, you know, whether it's Bitcoin or gold and silver, can absolutely be used to engineer a sort of deflationary scenario like we saw in Russia when Russia broke up.
Mm-hmm.
And if you use those systems in the United States, you can create a world of hurt that advantages the secret governance system, all in the theory that we're fixing the money system. And so be very careful of solutions based on sound money. You know, now that Mr. Global has stolen all the money, we're going to make his money sound and make sure we can't get back in the game. So be very wary of sound money solutions unless you're looking at the whole big picture. You asked me earlier, you know, what is an example of a fiat currency that worked? And so I think are you going to read the Guernsey experiment?
I will, but not until I ask my question, which is the issuance or having the availability of or having the capability of being able to issue money at that scale or giving out that high amounts of loaning out debt. Is that necessarily a problem if it were productive loans that they would be issuing the money for?
So there are two problems, okay? One is if the money, if the culture and the banking system is not fundamentally productive, you are going to get inflation and you're going to get a society wasting capital. So the system has to be run in a very tight and productive way. That's number one. But number two, the biggest problem logistically, operationally, is you can't claw out enormous amounts of secret financing. So we're talking about a system where you can't build and blow bubbles from which you can harvest these tremendous amounts of money. So if you look at the money that's been drawn out into what I consider, I would call the black budget, you can't hide the black budget and you can't pull out trillions of dollars for the black budget the way you can if you have a secret governance system that can bubble money in these ways.
Right. Well, that answers the question. Thank you, Catherine. Now on to the Guernsey experience. So Guernsey is a very interesting case.
Guernsey.
So Guernsey is a very interesting case in favor of fiat doing productive purposes. So Guernsey, I'm just going to read. It's also available on the screen. So Guernsey is an island state located among the British Channel Islands, about 75 miles south of Great Britain. In 1816, its seawalls were crumbling, its roads were muddy, and only 4.5 feet wide. Guernsey's debt was £19,000. The island's annual income was £3,000, of which £2,400 had to be used to pay interest on its debt. Not surprisingly, people were leaving Guernsey, and there was little employment. Then the government created and loaned new interest-free state notes worth £6,000. So the mind you, they didn't use a private institution to do this. Some £4,000 were used to start the repairs of the seawalls. In 1820, another £4,500 was issued, again, interest-free. In 1821, another £10,000. 1824, £5,000. 1826, £20,000. By 1837, £50,000 had been issued interest-free for the primary use of projects like seawalls, roads, the marketplace, churches, and colleges. And this sum more than doubled the island's money supply during this 13-year period. But there was no inflation. More than doubled the money supply, but there was no inflation. How can that be? In the year 1914, as the British restricted the expansion of their money supply due to World War I, the people of Guernsey commenced to issue another £142,000 over the next 4 years and never looked back. By 1958, over £542,000 had been issued, all without inflation. In 1990, there was $13 million in interest-free state-issued notes. A visitor to the island that year later wrote, quote, "I returned from Guernsey last weekend. It is a fascinating little island. There are about 60,000 permanent residents on the island. The average family owns 3.3 cars. Their unemployment rate is zero, and their standard of living is very high. There is no public debt. There is a surplus of public funds which earn interest. The Guernsey Treasury increased the M1 of the island by 40% in the last 3-year period, and this increase did not do anything to inflation. Nothing. The price for a gallon of gasoline in England translates to about $5, $5 US, whereas the price in Guernsey is about $2 US. Contrary to the teachings of current economics in all higher institutions, inflation is not related to the volume of money, but rather to the size of the commercial debt," end quote.
Right.
So
a great example of fiat currency in an economy where the money is being used productively.
There you go. So it can be done. Double the money supply with no inflation.
It can be done. I would note, though, that Guernsey did a nice, in the later years after World War II, a nice offshore business. So that added to the wealth.
Integral part of the spider's web, I suppose.
Yep.
All right. Myth number four, Catherine. War is happening someplace else.
So this one is one of the hardest to disabuse because we have this notion that war is happening in the Middle East and war is happening in the Ukraine, but it's not happening where we are. And yet, if you look at what's really going on, particularly with invisible weaponry, I mean, I think it's fair to say the people of Paradise, California, the people of Lahaina on Maui know that they are in a war. So one of the aspects of the war that I follow the most is what I call the great poisoning. I noticed a lot when I was driving around the United States in the 90s and the 2000s, you know, the population was literally steadily, because of the food, because of the spraying, because of the pharmaceuticals, they were becoming more and more poisoned. And there wasn't a consciousness of, wait a minute, I'm in a war. Somebody's trying to kill me. I have to protect myself. And so I need to take action. And one of the reasons it was happening is many of the weapons we're facing, whether it's EMF radiation or the great poisoning or the magic virus, they're invisible. Or if you look at the weapons that they used, you know, in Lahaina or Paradise, they're much less visible than a tank rolling into your neighborhood. And so we don't realize not only are we in a war, but also our minds and our bodies are part of the battlefield. I was just talking about the Biden versus Missouri case, in which one of the government agencies has asserted in a court of law that our minds are part of the national security infrastructure and they should be able to assert jurisdiction over our minds, what we think. I mean, it's remarkable, but there is a war. And we are a target in that war. We are on the battlefield. So truth number three, World War III is being waged with invisible weaponry, and we are in the middle of it. We are not only in the battlefield, our minds and our bodies are the battlefield.
Which is why you and your family need a war strategy.
Right.
Not just a financial strategy. You've said this time and time again.
Right.
And the Dutch flag we see on the right is upside down, signifying a country that is in dire need of help, that is signifying that something's very wrong. And up above the red horizontal flag, that's a farmer's napkin. So this is what the Netherlands is currently covered with. If you drive through rural parts of the Netherlands right now, you will see this sign over and over. You will see it all scattered across these different hay bales. They will build these hay bales up with outrageous text attacking the government policies. And these guys clearly are in a war. They are being targeted to be bullied off their lands. And these are family enterprises that have been successful for 200 plus years that are now forced to shut down, which is a very sad thing. So I would definitely argue that these guys need a war strategy. And maybe they need a, like in the old days, a guild of like-minded farmers that all operate together.
So I would say, because we've just published Pharma Food by Else von Hamelin and then the Dutch Farmers and Fishermen. And the goal of those two pieces was to help the farmers and fishermen and the people helping them see how they fit in into the whole central control grid. And Elsa did a marvelous job of just mapping out the whole thing. And we are hoping, you know, it's just about to come up in Dutch. We're hoping that if we can each see how we are a part of the whole, then together we can start to push back together. Because impairing the property rights of the farmers is only step one to impairing all of our property rights. So this is our fight, not their fight. It's one fight, and it's a global fight. And they are one of the local heroes pushing back against this. So we really hope that building, you know, again, this map will help them see the world whole and see that what is happening to them is not just about the farmers or the Dutch farmers. It's a far bigger game.
Exactly. And one thing we can all do to fight this quote unquote war is support our allies, support those local farmers and make sure that their business is successful, that it's financially stable, and they're able to supply it with healthy food instead of all the genetically modified food.
One of the things we felt after looking at doing this sort of big piece on the Dutch farmers and how they fit into the control grid, we wanted to make sure that you felt sufficiently motivated to really support your local farmers. So Elsa wrote Pharmafood, and I dare you to read Pharmafood. It's a spectacular, it's one of our most spectacular wrap-ups. When you understand, once they get control of your farmer, the kind of food and lab-grown meat and synthetic food they're planning on rolling out, well, first of all, you might not eat for 24 hours, but second of all, you get very serious about embracing your local farmers.
Exactly. And imagine adding CBDC on top of that, and then in Augustin Karsten's own words, they can control what you spend that currency on.
Right. So they can control your access to food.
That's right. If you've had too many steaks this year, Catherine, you're just going to be on greens for the remainder of the year.
They're going to get me. They're going to get me.
So this is a very interesting quote, again, straight from the horse's mouth. This is from Secretary of Defense William Cohen, who said this in 1997 at the University of Georgia. So this is a big conference where all these state officials come together, and they have this big talk about all these external threats to the United States. And they're talking about countries in the world that are weaponizing diseases. Mm-hmm. And then as he rambles on about all those external threats, he says, quote, others are engaging even in an echo type of terrorism, whereby they can alter the climate, set off earthquakes, volcanoes remotely through the use of electromagnetic waves, end quote.
Right. One of the most controversial items on the Solari Report over the last 10, 15 years is me talking about the ability to set off a tsunami, set off an earthquake, or weather warfare. And we always try and quote Secretary Cohen, because sometimes people will believe it. You know, they won't believe their own two eyes, but they'll believe it if the Secretary of Defense confirms.
You don't have to believe us. Just go straight to the source and hear it from the government officials. Or, for that matter, see what the Chinese did during the Olympics.
See that how was they so funny.
Manipulated the weather.
Skidmore, you can find this on the website. Skidmore did a wonderful bibliography on sort of all papers and academic papers on weather manipulation and management. And when he first approached me about this, you know, we'd done the missing money. So he had gotten more open about things being different than they were and sort of about the Solari map. But then when he said weather warfare can't really be true, I said, Mark, the Chinese government just announced that weather would not be a problem during the Olympics because they would take care of that. And he said, no. I said, there's a Beijing Office of Weather Modification. It has a Wikipedia page. Go to Wikipedia and read the Beijing Weather Modification Office web, you know, sort of description. So he did, and came away just stunned. And that's when he started to put the bibliography together. So, you know, this stuff is real. There's a wonderful video we often show of Lyndon Johnson in the 60s talking about how if you could control the weather, you control the whole world. And he clearly seems very excited about the possibility.
Well, it's clearly something you would have to account for if you were a farmer.
Right.
And if you accept the possibility of being inside of a war, you would clearly have to account for this being a possibility.
Right.
And if this is, it's so non-controversial, it's non-trivial, it's out there stated by guys like Cohen.
Right. Well, one of the breakthrough videos during the pandemic was the Canadian premier who was asked, I love this video and we show it often. He was asked to address why he was not permitting the citizens to have access to ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine. So he started to market the vaccine aggressively. And then you could tell he felt, you know, because the audience is going, why is he marketing the vaccine? We asked about ivermectin. And he starts to feel badly because he's doing the old political non sequitur two-step. And he starts to talk about, I want to thank the people who sent the rain. You know, without the rain, we you know, the farmers would not have a harvest and then the whole economy would go down. And what he was trying to tell them was he was being blackmailed. He was being blackmailed.
Yes.
It was a remarkable moment in the history of politics.
That's right. It's also interesting that two-step process you just explained. That was actually very helpful for me watching some of these political speeches or interactions or public debates that they're doing, where they get asked a question that's non-trivial. It's a very plain question. There's no tricks to it. And they just answer it by answering a question they never received.
Right. That was our training. Roger Ailes taught me We had to take, when I was a Republican surrogate speaker, we had to take courses. Roger Ailes was one of our teachers, and we were taught, if you get a question you don't want to answer, you are gracious and you thank the speaker, you compliment them on the question, and then you proceed to answer the question you wish you'd gotten, complete non sequitur. Yep. It works. Anyway,
so that's what the Canadian did. On to myth number 5. This is one of my favorites. Technology is making us more productive.
Yep.
It could be.
I love technology, and technology properly applied could absolutely make us much more productive, including all the technology that's been suppressed. In fact, what is true is technology is being used to build the control grid and to have an economy that is not a growth with no inflation, but to have really a harvesting machine that, in my opinion, has a negative return. So technology is creating more central control. And if you look at how it's working currently, it is phenomenally energy expensive. I mean, just phenomena. You and I were just up in Norway listening to, among other things, a petroleum engineer talk about the economics of the renewable energy combined with climate change rules and the ridiculousness of it and the huge energy that was being wasted. And then, of course, the conversation turned to, if you think this is bad, wait, you see what AI does.
Yeah.
So, the current energy model makes no sense, in part because of suppression of technology, but in part because it is really being used to implement central control, which is not productive as an economic matter and certainly doesn't serve the forces of freedom. But
no.
Again, helps. You know, if we look at this harvesting model, it's built to harvest. It's not built to produce a healthy economy or culture.
It's also taking away our personal productivity or personal power.
Right.
Simple thing is using your phone for all sorts of basic mental arithmetic.
Right.
Once you start doing that, you lose this power. You have to work hard to do the heavy lifting yourself and keep that brain educated. That's just a very simple example. But think about things like ChatGPT, using that to write all sorts of text. I mean, what will that do to writers? What will that do to their creative brains? Will they be stripped of their power in a way?
So, we're gonna end up using these tools. So, I don't know. We were brainstorming the subtitle on pharma food, and we really got stuck. We didn't like any of the 1,000 we already had, but we really got stuck. And so Robert put it into one of the AI programs, the open source AI, and it spewed out 30 or 40 new ideas, none of which we picked, but it opened up the whole, it just opened up our imaginations and off we went. And it worked really, really well. It was cute.
Right. So it can be used productively. I love my Casio. I use this for all sorts of things, but you have to do the heavy lifting on certain things yourself and just be very wary that you're not being phased out.
The scary one was our colleague who reported talking to young people this summer who had literally forgotten how to do the math of calculation because they used their smartphone, and they pointed out that their grades had gone down steadily ever since they got their smartphone. So it's
scary.
It's how you use it. It's how you use it. And we have a lot of material at Solari about how to use technology well, but it's your responsibility. And the question is, are you going to let it control you, or are you going to use it as a tool effectively?
Exactly. And one of the things somebody said this when we were in Scandinavia, they said, if it's free, you are the product. And that's a good framework to use whenever
I think Carolyn sent that.
Carolyn may have said that. That's right. Yeah. And that's a very useful framework whenever you use any application.
Yep. Absolutely.
I love my iPhone. I love having the ability to call my family when I'm abroad. But then when I start using applications or social media, I want to be very careful about the data that I put out there.
Right.
So that's just something to be aware of. Myth number 6, there is a magic bullet.
So, I love simple solutions. I love looking for simple, elegant solutions. The reality is we've had an economic model on this planet for 500 years. It's called the central banking warfare model. And when you talk about significantly changing or evolving that model, you're talking about the reinvention of everything. And there's no magic bullet and there's no quick solution. You know, I go back to fix the money, fix the world. That's not a, you know, first of all, fixing, you know, changing from the current currency system to another currency system is not a quick solution. But we're talking about a very fundamental change spiritually, culturally, economically, financially, and it gets back to the big governance system and how are we going to operate. So when you change a 500-year-old model, it's there are no shortcuts. This is a big, big change. We're talking about the reinvention of everything.
When you reinvent everything, Catherine, do you do that in tandem? Do you do that in parallel next to the current system? Because a lot of people seem to want to just abrogate everything in the old system because they say it's corrupt, it's bad. So just do away with it. And then you end up with this gray area in between where you've got nothing. I mean, that's not a productive way of doing it. So do we do it in parallel?
So I think we do it. I think we do it in parallel, but I think it's a day-to-day thing because what you're talking about is reinventing your life every day with your thoughts, with your actions, with your investment of time, with your investment of your resources. And it starts by, you know, I keep using this wonderful quote, the currency of the future will be relationships of trust. It starts with finding other people you can trust, particularly other people you can trust in the critical areas where you need help. You know, your doctor, your nurse, your, you know, the person you read to get your intelligence and your media, and on and on. If you go through all the areas of civilization where you need help, your farmer who, or your fisherman who, where you get your food. So in all the different areas of your life, how can you start to build relationships? And some of those relationships are going to be in existing institutions. Some are going to be in new institutions. And it's one day at a time as you evolve towards that which builds, you know, the most healthy. You're in a war, so you want to build systems that help you endure that war, stay alive in that war, and ultimately win that war. So it's that's why in a decentralized model, everybody's different, everybody's unique. So there's no way Ricardo and I can give you a formula for how it's going to work for you. You have to invent it bottom up.
Yes.
And you have to do it with a mind's eye of what are your skills and talents? Where do you want to go in this world? What's the purpose you serve? So it's not quick, it's not simple, and sometimes it can be a little bit overwhelming, which is why you just have to have confidence that if you keep chipping away at it, you can make enormous progress, but it won't be a shortcut.
It's a lot of hard work, yeah. But it can be fun too.
Right.
I will never forget the moment I first started buying my groceries locally. There's this farmer close to where I live that sells all sorts of dairy products. They sell ice cream. They sell raw milk. You can buy cheese. They've got eggs. They got chickens.
Uh-huh.
The prices that they offer to clients for, say, a pack of butter are, I would say, about half of what you would get in the grocery store. So just driving 5 extra minutes to go and collect my groceries over there drastically reduces my expenses on groceries. And it's way more fun. These are nice people. These are people that I want to interact with. So you can have your cake and eat it too, but you have to do some research. You have to go out of your way a little bit.
Making the transition at first takes a lot of work. Now, the more people you meet on the path and the more you network, then the faster it gets. Because you're part of a network and the network shares intelligence. I mean, if you get on the different commentaries on the Soleri report, We were having a wonderful conversation the other day about insulation, and one of the husbands of one of the subscribers jumped on. He used to be an architect and a building contractor, and he just laid it all out. It was unbelievable. It's great intelligence, but you know, that's, you have to build your networks, and as you do, things get easier and easier and easier.
Definitely, you start attracting different people,
right,
that may offer you different sources of intelligence. So.
Right.
You definitely want to rely on that. Which brings us to myth number 7. What I do with my money is not important. I'm too small. I don't really matter. It's just my bank account. Who cares?
Right. You're right. It's unbelievable. So, you know, the thing that moves the world are markets. And if we all stop shopping to the right and go shopping to the left, it's unbelievable. The and it's even tiny moves are really received in boardrooms of banks and companies in America or around the world. You know, it can make a remarkable difference. But the reality is, this is both a financial matter, but it's a political matter and a spiritual matter. What we do with our thoughts, with our time, with our intention and our resources matters, particularly in a highly leveraged system. If you have a very highly leveraged financial system and 1% of the people move to the left, you know, that can implode. Yeah, I mean, it's just remarkable the impact it can have.
You could cause a bank run, or you could make a collection of farmers extremely wealthy and secure their next 100 years of doing business.
Right.
So it definitely is the case that you and I have the power to transform
to
the
markets. Absolutely.
And to move them. Absolutely.
Right.
One thing that I wanted to read to you is from Marcus Aurelius, arguably one of our shared favorites, authors in the world. And Marcus talks a lot about, regardless of the outcome, just do the right thing.
Right.
If you die today, just be a good man today.
Right.
Don't care too much about tomorrow. Don't care too much about the result. Just be a good man today, is what he says. And in this quote that I'm going to read to you, he talks a little bit about doing that. So he says, quote, "Wherever something can be done, as the logo shared by gods and man dictates, there all is in order. Where there is profit, because our effort is productive, because it advances in step with our nature, there we have nothing to fear." So this is... he's talking about the fact that if you do something that is productive to mankind, to something that's godly, something that's in line with our nature, in line with the logos, sure, make a profit. It can be productive. It's contributing to the larger whole.
Right. But what he's saying is, you know, I call it being living in right relationship, both with the divine intelligence, but with other people. You know, you are being fundamental. You're adding value, and therefore people want you around. You're useful, right? And to me, it's very, very important. We're watching an economy that has a negative return on investment. Every one of us who says, wait a minute, I have the power to build wealth, and I'm going to build a positive return on investment economy. You get enough of us together, and it's a steamroll, because it, you know, a positive return produces more positive return produces more positive return. And it does it, as Richard points out, without inflation.
That's right.
Right.
And you also start to associate with people that have higher levels of integrity, which drastically reduces the amount of time you're going to lose. So there's all sorts of leverages that you can use. So it will impact your life. And in turn, it will impact your environment. And in turn, it will impact the broader society you live in, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a domino effect that starts with you.
Right.
Myth number 8, I'm sick. We hear this quite a lot these days.
Nope. I mean, some people are sick, but I would say what I see in this world, the majority of people are being poisoned. We are in the midst of a great poisoning, and it's many different things. That was the hard thing for me of sort of seeing it clearly as a great poisoning, because it's coming in the food, it's coming in the pharmaceuticals, it's coming in the spray. For everybody who recognizes that they've been poisoned, they identify it with a different source. And then if you look at the symptoms they get from their poisoning, they identify it as a different kind of disease. So it's a very complicated landscape, with people thinking they have thousands of different diseases, and it's caused by thousands of different things. And they haven't sat back and said, wait a minute, you know, there is a great poisoning, and it's impacting me. It's impacting my physical body. It's impacting my mind. It's impacting all aspects of life around me. We just had Toby Rogers on the Salieri Report. He did a wonderful job of describing. He had just written a Substack saying we need a new model for the economy in America to express how the economy works when the population is being poisoned. It's a very, you know, clear, simple, accurate picture of what's happening. And Toby has the great ability to kind of go to the heart of the matter. And boy, this, there's no more important myth we need to understand in terms of managing our money, because one of the greatest causes of loss and drain of family wealth, Ricardo, is health problems. So you and I talk a lot about this, and you know how much one bad dinner making you sick can cost you in a week of, you know, if you've ever had food poisoning, you know how much time you lose.
Oh, you get knocked out of the labor force for a couple of days, and
right.
Your state of amusement is gone. Your power's been stripped. It's not right. A fun experience. So
right, and it's expensive.
It is.
So right. So I think if every family could identify the fact that there is a great poisoning and decide, okay, I'm smart, we're going to work together, we're going to understand this, and we're going to learn how to protect ourselves and outwit, it will make tremendous amounts of difference to your health long run, but it will make huge difference to your money.
Exactly.
As an investment advisor, what I saw again and again is people were, their number one financial problem was they were being poisoned and they hadn't clearly recognized it and weren't taking evasive action.
It's a phenomenal drain on productivity.
Right.
And getting sick is a very extreme case of that, but
right.
Just not feeling optimal and having brain fog chronically,
right.
You
right.
Can't make the right choices. You can't right. Do the right thing. So
right.
you want to weapon yourself against that. You want to have this shield right. of good food that's healthy.
Right. And I have to say, you know, I would never have seen it if it hadn't been for the fact that I'd been poisoned on multiple occasions during the litigation. And what was so interesting is I couldn't fathom that someone like me would be intentionally poisoned. I just couldn't, you know, I couldn't believe that was happening. And so it took me a while to kind of understand it. And of course, you understand these, the more spooky people you meet, the more they teach you and you come to understand it. And then as I was going through the detox process, first of all, I was noticing the dramatic impact it had on my health and my ability to think and function. But the other thing is I started to watch all the other people as I traveled extensively, and I realized, oh, everybody's being poisoned. It's not just me. Mm-hmm. It's happening to everybody. So
exactly.
Right.
And that's your case is, again, it's a very extreme case where a malevolent institution or collection of institutions was definitely out to get you. But there's also... Right. On the broader scale to everybody out there, whether
right.
It's a malevolent institution targeting you or whether it is just a byproduct of large industry putting poison in the water.
Right. So some of it is people being, you know, taking shortcuts in terms of the environment. So that's
sure.
Definitely happening. But if you look at the level of malevolence in, for example, some of the pharmaceutical products and mandates, we're talking about mass atrocity. We're talking about intentional poisoning, intentional depopulation.
Exactly.
And I think that's hard for many of us to face and digest. But if you look at it this way, the point is not to dwell on it or pick a fight with anybody. You want to say, okay, now how am I going to get radical about protecting myself? And that's why it's so important that you establish good local sources of fresh food.
If you find PFAS in your local water, in the water that's
right.
coming out of the tap, you don't
right.
roll up in a ball and start crying. You get a water filter.
Right. So I just want to say to everybody who has tried so hard to get their spouse to go along with establishing local sources of food, I want you to get a copy of Pharma Food in physical copy. Because
That'll
if your
it.
Spouse is not on board, they will get on board now.
That'll
this
do
will
it.
Do it. This will do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
You'll feel much better after you make that transition. Myth number 9, quote, we are here to help, end quote.
Yeah. What did Reagan say was the one great lie? I'm from the government. I'm here to help. Okay. So we hear many cover stories. Oh, we didn't know what we were doing. It was a mistake. We were incompetent. We were rushed. Or, you know, we just didn't care. We were apathetic. So we were faithless. Or it's very complicated. You know, when I worked in the federal government, that was one of their, it's really complicated and the bureaucrats are stupid and they just made a mistake. And the funny thing is that the system, the beauty of the system is this, if the system goes in a wrong direction that is not compatible with the real goal, they'll immediately learn and fix it. But if it continues to go in that direction while somebody chronically says, oh, it's a mistake, it's, we didn't know, we can't do it. You know, don't believe it. The system's working and it's going where it's supposed to go. And, you know, there are a lot of cover stories to cover for the financial fraud and the healthcare fraud. But ultimately, we have to face the fact we are in a war. We are a target. Somebody is trying to kill us, and we have to take action.
That's right. And back to Richard Werner, if you look at either the book or the documentary Princes of the Yen, you see the perfect example of this, where the central bank, Richard advised them to buy up, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he said non-performing loans.
Right, right.
So the central bank prints money and buys non-performing loans from commercial banks. That way you have a solution for the economy going through a very hard period without any inflation. But they didn't want this. They wanted to sustain that trough in the economy. They wanted to sustain it. So there was a different agenda.
Right. This is one of the problems when you are occupied by an occupying army.
That's right.
Right.
All right, Catherine, you ready for the final?
Yep.
Myth number 10, only the material world is real. If my senses can witness it, then it's real. And if they don't, it's just hokey pokey.
Right. And it's interesting.
That's the truth.
There's so much, you know, including the material, which is invisible to the naked eye, but we also have an energetic and spiritual world and a cultural world that is invisible to the naked eye. And yet, if you look at our greatest sources of power, both individually and collectively, they come from that which is not invisible to the naked eye. And if we just consider the material, particularly the material that we can see, the entirety of reality, we're going to miss the whole big play. And so we clearly are dealing with people who are acting against our best interests, who do see the whole play. They see the spiritual. They grapple with whether or not our souls are immortal, which I am absolutely confident they are. So a lot of our power comes from seeing the world whole, and that includes seeing the material and that which is non-material and that which is invisible, and have an integrated picture of all of them. And I struggle on how to help people understand this, because I think each person has to find it in their own way. There are different things you can study. There are different people you can read. There are different teachers who are excellent on these topics. But ultimately, a great deal has been done to suppress the knowledge of the invisible realms. It's astonishing. And a lot of course, the way we're tricked is, you know, nanoparticles, because we can't see them. So part of getting a really good map of the world is understanding that it's not just the material world that you can see. It's not just the world you can see with your naked eye. It's a much bigger, you know, there's a lot more going on, and a lot of it is spiritual, and a lot of it is invisible, and on the spiritual side, it's eternal. You're in an eternal game or war.
I think the word eternal is really important here, and the reason why is because it's larger than just your life. If you look at the cathedral you see in the picture, or if you travel around places like Eastern Europe or Southern Europe across the Mediterranean, you see a lot of these places that were heavily involved by Catholicism. You see these huge cathedrals that are built throughout many generations. This wasn't just one generation doing this in 10 or 20 years, and that's it. But these were fathers who passed it on to their sons, who passed it on to their sons, and they never saw the end product, but they believed in something larger than their own life.
Right. So they were willing to build a building that would take longer than their life to build. They would never see the final creation. And that's a whole approach to civilization, which I find remarkable. And I think that's one of the things I most respect about the human race, is our ability to do that, is our ability to look beyond our lifetime and envision the creation of things that build great civilizations. Because in many respects, that is how long it takes. When I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, the secretary used to ask me for, you know, how could we change this? And I said, well, you know, it takes It takes 20 years to raise a child and educate them properly and make sure you have a strong, healthy being. And a successful society is raising each of those children one at a time successfully. And he would say, that takes too long. I need something faster. And I would say, there's no shortcut. You know, it's back to the shortcut thing. So one of the beliefs I have is one of the things that makes an extraordinary difference to operating in this environment, in a very chaotic environment where there's significant corruption, and that is understanding that we, our souls are immortal, that we are not, you know, we're in the material world for just a certain period, but our souls are immortal. And so I love the quote from Marcus Aurelius, what we do now echoes in eternity. I told you last night, I had one teacher, she was a Buddhist, and she said that in her practice of Buddhism, if you lived a good life, you could improve the karma of your family 7 years back, 7 generations back and 7 generations forward. And I said, wow, that's really leverage.
That's a big ROI on your decisions in
right,
this lifetime.
Right, that's a big ROI. So
it is.
I think, you know, one of the advantages of being trained by the establishment is I was trained to think in planning increments longer than a lifetime. You know, that was the way we were trained. That was the way we thought. You know, we thought we were part of building a civilization. And mm-hmm. it's a great way to think. It's a great way to be, because it helps you really come to your power and understand. And that's why I want so much to encourage people to believe I'm a wealth builder, because building wealth starts with believing, oh, I am a wealth builder. It was one of the reasons I sent you to see the Book of Kells, this number, truth number 10. So the Book of Kells is beautiful manuscripts in Dublin, coming from monasteries that spent 800 years painting out and handwriting the Bible. And
on calfskin.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. When you look at it, you think, wow, you know, take the time to do it right.
That's right.
Yeah.
I want to ask you a question, Catherine, which sort of dovetails out of this statement you just made about believing in something larger than your own life. When you hear Alan Jackson, one of our favorite pastors in World Outreach Church in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, when you hear him talk, he always says that there's a tremendous pressure on Christianity throughout the world, that there's a war going on. Why do you think that is the case? Why don't they, whoever they is, why don't they want that?
Well, I think people who truly understand that their soul is immortal are impossible to control. And you know, if you are a Christian, you believe that Jesus taught you to be free. In other words, and that no, our freedoms, it's what you read in the Bill of Rights and the Constitution or the Declaration of Independence, our freedoms come to us by divine authority. They are inalienable rights. Once you understand that and you understand their connection, this connection with the divine, mm-hmm. you cannot be controlled by man. You cannot. They can harm or destroy your physical body, but they cannot corrupt your immortal soul. So, you know, you get enough people together believing in Christ, and you got a whole bunch of ornery people.
Mm-hmm. Yes. But yeah. If you just optimize for this physical existence, that you would sacrifice the spiritual or the eternal.
Yeah.
The short-term physical.
We're all going to start doing genocide in the hospitals so that we can keep our Netflix going, right?
Exactly. Or give me that injection. I don't really want that injection, but just give it to me so I can go
travel.
On this. I want to travel to Turkey. I just want to go, so just do it.
Right.
All right. All right, Catherine. Well, working with you has been a tremendous learning journey, and my map is definitely a lot clearer thanks to that. So I thank you for that. I really
do. I truly believe that if we can each understand the important frameworks, as we wander through the world and things are topsy-turvy and there's lots of noise, if you have some of these important myths disabused and you understand these basic truths, it can make it much easier to navigate, which is important because if you look at the kind of uncertainty we're facing, each one of us has to take responsibility to build their own map and to update it and make sure it's correct. And the Solari Report wants to do everything we can help you to do to get a good map, but ultimately you have to take responsibility. And So if you have these frameworks, it makes it easier for you to do it yourself.
It's like a pair of lenses. Once you have them, every new problem you can look through with these lenses.
Right.
And that you're never taking the bait again. Right. Because you're now equipped with this set of lenses that allows you to look at reality and not fall for right. the official reality and the story.
Well, what it means is the enemy may kill you, but hopefully the enemy cannot take away your state of amusement, at least for a long time. Okay, Ricardo.
All right. So this is the conclusion. And this, of course, is a satellite image of what the actual island of California looks like, which is a peninsula attached to the mainland.
Yeah.
So there you have it. Myth busted.
Can you believe it took an order of the king to kill the map?
And the interesting thing is after 50 years, they knew. In the early 1500s, this first map was drawn. And then
You had so many explorers who said that they had sailed around the island that if you canceled it, you would say that they were liars. And that was a real political problem. It's kind of... Anyway, we have a similar problem today with tearing up our official narrative maps. But don't tear them up. We need them because we got to navigate both. But,
We don't need to listen to the King of Spain. We just need to listen to Augustin Carstens and the like. Just hear it straight from the horse's mouth. There you go.
Right. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us for Busting the Myths in Your Money Map on the Solari Report. Ricardo, thank you. Have a great day, everyone. Bye.
Bye-bye.